This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
So this question comes from Gillian, and Gillian asks, what's the biggest danger we face from space and what can we do about it? Well, space is full of danger. The universe isn't a hospitable place for life, and there's only one tiny part of it that we know about so far where life is possible, and that's the Earth itself. But even that's not completely shielded from danger. For example, the sun, in a few billion years, is going to expand and scorch the Earth, possibly even consume it altogether. That is going to happen, but that poses absolutely no danger to you in your lifetime. By a very wide margin, the largest hazard facing our sanctuary on Earth is impact from a large enough comet or asteroid. Most of the asteroids in the solar system lie between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, and perturbations on their orbits, either from gravitational interactions with Jupiter or with each other, can send them into the inner solar system on potentially Earth-crossing orbits. Others just live in the inner solar system on highly eccentric orbits, i.e. orbits that are not circular but shaped more like an ellipse, and this can make them quite difficult to spot. We often see on the news that an asteroid has passed by the Earth and was only discovered near its closest approach to the Earth. Luckily, so far, all of these have safely passed us by, but it does mean that we're insensitive to detecting a large fraction of the objects out there until they're too close to give us any time to devise ways of stopping them from hitting. The problem with asteroids is they are difficult to find. They're small, and they tend to be dark in colour, and the eccentric nature of their orbits means that they're likely to come at us from the direction of the sun. This is a problem because searching for small objects near the sun is difficult, as the sun is quite bright, and so the glow from a little rock isn't going to be very noticeable. Secondly, if they're coming at us from the direction of the sun, they're lit from the back, which isn't very helpful. As they get closer, they may appear as a lit crescent, similar to when the moon is mostly backlit, and so you're only seeing light from a small part of an already small object. Fortunately, the more dangerous the object, the bigger it is, and the bigger it is, the easier it is to spot. We think we've got most of the dinosaur killers catalogued, and there's nothing coming our way in the near future that's that cataclysmic. However, it doesn't take a huge rock, maybe a few hundred yards across, to wipe out a city. With enough warning, though, there are things we can do. If you've seen the film Armageddon, you'll remember that they trigger a load of bombs on and in an impactor. This is a bad idea for two possible reasons. One, turning an impactor into lots of little impactors by shattering it into pieces is probably not going to minimise the total damage to the Earth. You're just turning a localised impact into a worldwide blitz. Secondly, the composition of the asteroid matters. If it's of a very low density, and some asteroids have been measured to have the density of, say, cork or even foam, then there's a chance that the impactor will simply just absorb the energy from the explosion. Alternatively, the asteroid could be made of iron, in which case, triggering nuclear bombs on the surface just isn't going to do much to disrupt its physical integrity. In this case, you're potentially making this worse, as you now have a radioactive asteroid coming in instead of just an asteroid. Another possibility is that we trigger a series of small explosives on the surface. The impulses from these will slowly change the orbit from a dangerous one to a safe one, which sounds reasonable in theory, but in reality could be very hazardous, as if we get it wrong, we potentially change the orbit from one that's quite dangerous to one that's very dangerous. Also, asteroids tend to be quite rapid and erratic rotators, which can add extra complications to doing this. A plausible possibility to move an asteroid out of the way is a process called gravitational tethering. This involves sending a small spacecraft to the asteroid and using the self-gravity of the spacecraft itself to gently redirect the asteroid onto a safe trajectory. This has the advantage of being effective regardless of the composition of the asteroid. Additionally, having spacecraft gravitationally locked to an asteroid would allow extremely precise calculations of its orbit, allowing us to measure its long-term trajectory. Even more exciting is the possibility of moving it into a safe orbit around the Earth, where we could continuously mine it for resources. So the upshot is that given enough time we can act, and the asteroids themselves don't necessarily have to present a problem on their own, as there are things we can do about them. Time is the key factor in this, as they're quite difficult to detect, and so more resources should be directed to finding them as well as making movies about them. But like I said, dinosaur killers are rare, and we have most of them catalogued, we think, and there are people looking out for the city killers. There's a programme called the B612 Foundation which aims to have 90% of near-Earth asteroids greater than a few hundred metres across catalogued by a new space observatory called Sentinel, and we'll place a link to their website in the show notes. Also, if you're interested in knowing what's trespassing in our backyard at the moment, you can look at NASA's Near Earth Object Program at neo.jpl.nasa.gov.
What would happen if our galaxy ended up colliding with another one?
Well, I've actually done research on this, although not specifically on the Milky Way. The Milky Way frequently collides with and absorbs many dwarf galaxies, and is also expected to eventually merge with the Andromeda Galaxy, which is the closest spiral galaxy to ours. When dwarf galaxies fall into the Milky Way, they typically get stretched and distorted by the gravitational force exerted by the Milky Way itself. Most of the stars eventually fall into the Milky Way, but since the stars don't collide with anything that can stop their motion, they eventually end up orbiting the Milky Way, albeit in strange orbits that take the stars way outside the plane of the galaxy. The gas within the dwarf galaxy would smack into the gas within the disk of the Milky Way galaxy and would end up eventually settling within the disk of our own galaxy. After a while, you would not be able to tell that much of anything happened at all. You would just see the Milky Way galaxy as a spiral galaxy with a few more stars and strange orbits and a little bit more gas. However, when two spiral galaxies merge together, as we expect the Milky Way and the Andromeda Galaxy to do in a few hundreds of millions of years, the first thing that happens is that the two spiral galaxies get severely distorted. So stars in the outer parts of the spiral galaxies would get flung out in long extended features called tails, while a bridge may form between the galaxies once they get close enough together. Eventually, the two disks will merge together. The orbits of the stars, which don't have anything to stop them, will end up completely scrambled. They will look like they're traveling in random directions, and the stars in the galaxy that forms from the merger will end up looking like a ball. The gas from the disks in both galaxies will smack into each other, and all of this gas will stop moving, and then fall into the center of the merged system. Now, in space, when you cause gas clouds to collapse, they typically form stars. So if you take all of the gas in two large spiral galaxies, like the Milky Way and Andromeda Galaxy, you're going to form a huge amount of stars. And astronomers typically call this a starburst. That's the same name as the starburst candies. The starburst would probably end up using up all of the gas within the merged galaxy. So when the Milky Way and Andromeda Galaxy have finished merging, you would no longer have any gas to form stars. You would just be left with this ball of stars which are slowly getting older over time. And the merger remnant would end up looking like an elliptical galaxy. So that's what we expect to happen when the Milky Way galaxy merges with the Andromeda galaxy. But that's a very long time into the future.
Oliver has asked us, what can you see through a telescope? So the short answer, Oliver, is you can see anything through a telescope if the telescope is pointing at it. A telescope is basically just a device to look at things which are far away, because it helps us to make things which are far away look bigger and closer. So that's the short answer. but I'm assuming you wanted a bit more than that. The long answer is we have all different kinds of telescopes depending on the kind of thing we want to look at. The telescope you might be most familiar with is called an optical telescope, and that is for looking at light that we can see with our eyes. So, in other words, it looks at things that we are already capable of seeing ourselves, but they're just too far away for us to see. So, for example, stars and planets and, you know, anything in space, really. And it works by collecting the light from these distance objects and magnifying it so that the things that it's looking at are big enough for us to see. So that's what you can see with an optical telescope. But those things I just mentioned, so stars and planets and also galaxies and lots of other things, even things that you wouldn't necessarily even think of as being things, for example, like bits of dust that are floating around in space. They also emit other types of light that we can't see with our eyes. So the light that we can see with our eyes is the colours of the rainbow, so red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo and violet. I'm sure you're already familiar. The human eye is capable of seeing those colours, and those colours have different wavelengths. But there are other wavelengths above and below that spectrum, above and below those colours in the rainbow, that we can't see. So for example, microwaves. I mean, I know you can see the microwave in your kitchen, but it's called a microwave because it emits a type of light called microwaves. We can't see radio waves, which are the kind of waves that the telescope at Jodrell Bank is able to see. We can't see X-rays. We can't see infrared light, which is what's emitted when something is very hot. So there's all these different types of light that the human eye can't see, but that gets emitted from things in space and that we want to see because it might tell us different information about the objects that we're looking at. So the visible light, the light on the optical spectrum that comes from a star, that tells us some things about the star, but we can learn more about it by looking also at the X-rays and the radio emission. It just tells us different parts of the story about that star. So the Lovell telescope sees radio waves and we use it to look at all kinds of different things. Like there's the dust that I mentioned before that a lot of astronomers are very interested in. I use it myself to look not at stars, but at clouds that are around stars. Not clouds like full of rain, but of material that gets expelled from the surface of the star when there's an explosion. So you can see that in the optical, but you can get kind of a, not a better look at it, but a different look at it at radio wavelengths. And you can look at how fast it's expanding and what it's doing. There's also a big group of people here who use the Lovell telescope to look at pulsars, which are a really interesting type of star that sort of flashes on and off really quickly. A little bit like a lighthouse, they're sometimes described. Some people use radio telescopes to look at galaxies that are really, really far away. So all the visible light from the galaxies gets absorbed on its path here to Earth. It gets absorbed by other things in space that are between it and us, but the radio waves come straight to us, so we can use the radio emission to see them, whereas we wouldn't be able to use the optical light to see them. So I know I've leaned kind of heavily on radio telescopes here because that's what I do, but I hope that begins to answer your question as to what we can see through a telescope. Like I said, the short answer is anything we want. Obviously, there's a more complicated answer too, which I've tried to give you. So I hope that helps, Oliver. Thank you for your question.